Initiate countdown.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Warning.
She's alive! Alive!
Warning.
Puny man matches his cunning against a monster from Mars running rampant.
Warning.
Dead or alive, you are coming with me.
Warning.
You gotta tell him! Silent Breed is people!
Warning.
Hello, pretty.
Warning.
Welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast.
With your host, Terry Frost.
The Martian Drive-In Podcast is a four-weekly podcast of speculative fiction movie appreciation. Each 4 weeks, Terry and his guests will pick two movies and strip them to the bone. They can be new, old, or in between science fiction, fantasy, or horror. What they have in common is that they aren't the big blockbusters that everyone knows about. Martian Drive-In looks for the interesting films that might not be on your radar, but that might just be worth your attention and appreciation. Go to marsdrivein.blogspot.com. Feedback is always welcome via email at cultguru@gmail.com. That's K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U at gmail.com. Or you can leave a voicemail at area code 206-2033-299. Enjoy!
Welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 6. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I have a guest. I'm going to do all of the other stuff later, but I'm going to introduce my guest first, the lovely Narelle M. Harris. How are you, Narelle?
I'm fine, thank you, Terry. How are you?
Oh, it's Saturday afternoon. I've done exercise, which is uncharacteristic, but
I know.
But I'm doing good.
I didn't do any exercise.
You live in the city. You don't have to. Everything's at your fingertips.
It is. Yeah. I'm lazy.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about your fun stuff writing vampire novels, because we're talking about two vampire movies this time. And you are the subject matter expert, as far as I'm concerned, on some of these things.
That happens a little bit by default. I've written a vampire novel, two vampire novels, actually, both set in Melbourne. There was The Opposite of Life, which was the first one. And it's about a librarian and a very uncool vampire named Gary, who lives in Glen Waverley.
Poor bastard.
Yeah, he's short and chubby and wears Hawaiian shirts, and he has no sexy at all.
Yeah, which is unusual for people living in Glen Waverley now. It tends to be all kind of, you know, lean greyhound human beings who went to private schools these days.
I know, but Gary's from the 60s.
He is from the 60s.
Yeah, he's still very square in that sense. And the sequel, Walking Shadows, just came out this year. So, yeah.
And I've read them both, and without blowing smoke up Narelle's ass, they are good. If you go to narellemharris.com, you can check them out and find out how to buy them from there. And I recommend you do if you're interested in this sort of stuff, because it is shit hot.
Oh, thank you.
That's okay.
But yeah, one of the consequences of that is Gary, the vampire character, actually collects films and books about vampires. So as a result, I've tended to watch I've seen and read a lot of often quite terrible vampire fiction in the pursuit of making Gary more of an expert.
You got to know your enemy, don't you?
You do,
yeah.
You do.
Well, Gary could well review these two movies.
He may well do that on my website. I sometimes do reviews of Gary unless they're discussing vampire-related fiction. So.
No, that sounds good to me. Anyway, have you been watching anything decent lately, in genre form?
Oh, you know, there's Doctor Who, as usual. Yeah. I recently, just last week, I watched all of Teen Wolf.
Why?
First season. Basically because of Hot Boys, I think. A friend recommended it to me. And 3/4 of the way through, it's fine. But, you know, I did high school horror with Buffy, and Buffy did it really, really well. And, you know, I'm 47 now. Actually, yeah. Teenage boys don't do it for me. But
glad to hear it.
Yeah.
You could end up being a private school teacher.
I could. It'd be very worrying. And the female characters didn't seem terribly strong. But about 3/4 of the way through that first season, the female characters lifted their game and became much more interesting. And there's a particular male character. He very well played. The character's name is Styles, and he's the smartest kid in the school, got a sassy, smart aleck mouth on him, and actually he's the best character in the entire series. I may well watch the second season just for him.
Okay, fair enough. Anything else?
No, that's all I can think of. I really enjoyed the last season of Torchwood, so I'm in the process. I've seen that, and I'm now going to watch it again with my husband, Tim, who hasn't seen it.
T- Tim's currently on his way back from Canada.
Yeah, he's been to Montreal and Quebec, and I think he's in Halifax at the moment.
Yeah, that's what he said on his Facebook, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Oh, well, that's good. That'll be
he's
sweet.
He's off having adventures, and I'm here, you know, writing.
Which in itself is an adventure.
Oh, it's always good. You know, it's like I don't have to be sociable, so I can just concentrate on the writing. And
no,
you know.
No, that's good, yeah.
And I, you know, like I actually haven't had to do housework. Well,
You did vacuum.
If Tim is listening, the house has been pristine for the last 2 weeks. Absolutely. Yeah. You could eat your dinner off this
place. About to, yeah.
Mm.
But, yeah, so you told me you did vacuum before I came here. I feel very honoured.
Oh, you should be.
Absolutely. But, yeah, like... so I've been doing a few things too. Last week, it was played last week, but last week Ivor and I did for the radio gig Last Tango in Paris, which was a challenge because some guy called Robin Nightcliffe in Darwin dared us to do Last Tango in Paris. And I think I said something silly like, there is a sexual act where butter is used as a lubricant. I didn't say you fucked her in the ass. But I was trying to be really nice about it, and one of the things that I found out doing my research for it, because I do a fair bit of research for these.
You want to make sure the butter was room temperature.
Well, it was
straight from the fridge.
Was.
That is not going to work.
No, it was room temperature because Marlon Brando's character Paul was slathering it on a baguette, sitting on the floor in the room. So yes, it was room temperature. But the weird thing I found out that really kind of fucked me up doing the review of this was that was a very traumatic scene to film for Maria Schneider, the actress. She was 19, and I don't think she was prepared for the kind of role it was. So I kind of became ambivalent about the movie as we were talking about it and before we were talking about it. So I don't think it was one of my best reviews, but we took the challenge, we did the movie, and there is some really gangbuster acting in it, particularly by Brando. So we kind of saved that one, but I'm not sure I'm going to take too many dares on the radio again because next thing is going to be is like Beyond the Green Door and Deep Throat or something like that. We'll end up getting those kind of dares if we're not
just
careful.
Just review the porn.
Well, yes, that'd be an interesting thing for ABC to do. I'm not sure it's in their charter to review pornography, but but we'll see how we go.
Bez
Noir,
we did that, maybe,
and we did Curse of Frankenstein, the first Hammer colour horror film. I recorded that last night, and that's going out next Thursday night. And we're getting you to do Dracula, perhaps.
Maybe, yeah. Hopefully I'll have time this week.
If you don't, I'll do a shout-out to you. Yeah, sounds which you'll good. Hear because it's in Darwin, but you can stream it. But, yeah, so we're doing three of the first three big Hammer horror films, which is Curse of Frankenstein, Dracula and The Mummy. So we're doing them 3 weeks in a row. Keeps me off the streets on Friday nights.
And we need to keep you off the streets, Terry.
Well, yes, I know. With those restraining orders, it becomes very... kind of hard to get out of.
There's so many of them, you never know which boundary you're overlapping there.
Yeah, well, that's it. I've got to stalk people on Facebook to find out who I'm not allowed to be near. Anyway.
Pulling back a little from Wrongtown there.
Yeah, okay, yeah. But I'm not going to edit this out. Fuck it. Yeah, so basically, the two movies we're doing this time are from 1959, one of the last Universal horror films in that cycle that started way back in 1931 with movies like Dracula and Frankenstein. It's Curse of the Undead, starring Australia's Michael Pate as a vampire gunslinger. First Australian actor I can find that played a vampire.
Let alone a vampire gunslinger.
And also from 2000, we've got Shadow of the Vampire with Willem Dafoe in his Oscar-nominated role as Max Schreck. And also John Malkovich and Eddie Izzard and people like that in it. So it's
Cary Elwes makes it.
Cary Elwes, yeah. I thought your eye candy would have to be in there, the Cary Elwes thing. Sal's hot on him too. I think, yeah, The Princess Bride, women should watch that sitting on towels just because he's so hot in that apparently.
I'm more of an Inigo Montoya's girl.
Well, there you go. Yeah, a little bit of Mandy Patinkin before he turned into a teddy bear.
Teddy Bear Mandy's okay by me too.
Okay, well, there you go.
So, yeah, it's an excellent cast in Shadow of the Vampire, and it's a... but full of all those actors who are slightly quirky and who frequently when they show up you think, I think as a human being individual, I suspect you keep nasty things in your basement. John Malkovich is always a little scary.
Yeah, I liked him in Red where he kind of had the machine gun hiding in the teddy bear kind of thing.
I just watched that again this week. I love that film.
I only watch it because Helen Mirren has machine guns in it.
That's the reason I watched it the first time. Helen Mirren, ball gown, machine gun, I'm there.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got to be. And, you know, I'll pretty much give any Bruce Willis movie a go ever since I won $500 watching Die Hard once.
Oh, that's always going to be a good thing.
Some asshole bet me on who a character actor was in Die Hard. How many people do you know who are that stupid to bet me on who a character actor is?
I don't know anybody that stupid, Terry.
No, well, he was a charter airline pilot, an American. I was living in Canberra at the time. And he bet me that the CEO of Nakatomi Corporation was played by Toshiro Mifune. I went, no, James Shigeta, American Japanese actor. No, it wasn't. Blah, blah, blah. And he goes, I'll bet you. And I said, how much? Because I know my stuff. Anyway, $500, and I was broke then. I had like $25 in the bank. I went, yeah, okay.
You realise you were taking advantage of a madman?
Yeah.
Okay, but on the other hand,
at the time, the exchange rates worked in his favour, so it wasn't a big deal. But yeah, that was one of my great moments of trivia.
Moment. Well, I think in the podcast, everyone, we should just leave a moment silence for the applause.
I don't hear it, but I can always... I'll tell you what, I will edit in applause. I can get some.
That's good. We'll just project that into there.
Yeah,
that's
we'll put applause in there. But yeah, so I'm going to take a little bit of a break now. We're 9 minutes in, and we'll get another plug in for you at the end of the podcast.
Oh, darn.
And then we'll come back. And which one do we talk about first? Curse of the Undead?
Curse of the Undead, I think.
Yeah, we'll do a bit of vampire gunslinging.
Imagine what this world's coming to. A nice young gal can offer $100 for a killing.
She must want to see somebody dead real bad.
Yeah, from the looks of this, she sure does.
What's the matter with the law around here? Can't he take care of things?
Oh, we got a good sheriff, but you know how some folks are. The law ain't never enough.
No, sometimes it isn't. That's good for me.
Oh, you interested in this sort of work?
Could be. Why do you ask?
I got the best reason in the world. This poster's me. Sure thought I was worth more than 100. This goes to show you how little a man knows about himself. Where are you going?
To see the nice young lady about the $100.
No, I wouldn't do that.
You're lucky I was shooting for nothing. If money was on my gun, I'd have drilled a deep bloody hole right between your eyes.
For a man who was late with his draw, you sure came out on top.
That's the idea.
If you're looking to make some money, I could put you to work. I got some good pay and easy jobs on my ranch.
Thanks, but I'll stick with my own profession. I've been at it a long time.
You declaring in front of all of us you're gonna gun me down?
If I'm hired, I'll complete the job. I always do. Nothing personal.
Mister, you just gave me the right to kill you.
You have the right to do anything you want, if you can do it.
I'm warning you, you're gonna start something you won't be able to finish.
Could be. Only time will tell which one of us speaks the truth.
Okay, and we're back, and that was a clip from Curse of the Undead, written and directed by Mr. What's his name again? Dean?
Edward Dane.
Edward Dean, written by him and his wife. They did it kind of as a joke, because he said what we should do is we'll have a vampire in a Western who's gay and is going around biting guys. That was their original concept for it. They did it as, you know, you sit around, shoot the shit and make silly ideas. And that was their idea. And somebody was walking past who was in programming at Universal. They didn't, the commissary. And said, okay, we'll make that. And they went, okay, we're going to have to tweak it then. And
take the queer out.
Yeah, we'll take the queer out. But
It's funny you should say that, because there was a moment, the first time that the vampire, Michael Pate, one of the first times you see him, he kind of opens up this coffin lid and he stares inside. Mm. And at the time, initially, I thought he was looking into the coffin of a dead male character. Yeah. And I'm sitting there going, you know, clearly I've been watching too much Teen Wolf this week, because this vampire cowboy appears to be having eye sex with the corpse of the doctor. And now he's crawling into the coffin with him. Whoa. Hang on here, Universal. What
you've been
are
watching
you doing?
Too many slash. You've been reading too much slash.
Just too much slash in my life. But yeah. There was a whole lot of eye fucking going on for a moment. But I think he just really, really likes his coffin.
Yeah, I think he does really. But yeah, so this is one of the last of the Universal horror films. There was about a 20-year run of them, running from about 30-year run, running from 1931 on to towards the end this movie, and going through all of the Dracula and Frankenstein onto the Creature from the Black Lagoon and all that kind of thing. And anyway, this, it wasn't a large budget movie. You can tell that from the fact that there aren't too many names in it, and it all tends to be on several different sets. So it was kind of low budget. And one of the things I love about it right from the start is the creepy theremin music on the soundtrack. It's just every time you see Michael Pate's character slip out of the shadows, they do the theremin kind of sting. And I might actually see if I can grab for that and put it here. yeah, because I love that kind of universal horror theremin stuff.
Oh, you just got to love a theremin wherever it is, really.
Yeah, but in a Western, it's an electronic instrument.
Basically. And it's not, because it's often used in more like science fiction.
It is.
Films and stuff like that, or maybe ghost sorts of things. So its use there was just, it just gave that little sense of it being off. But as a Western, because it was very clearly a very Western kind of plot, because I'm watching it and I'm waiting for the vampire. And I said, okay, we've had a couple of girls bitten, and then that storyline just vanishes for a little while, and it's, okay, so now we have the bad guy, mean ranch, who's trying to take over the property of the other ranch, and can we have the vampire back, please? And it was very traditional.
They're doing that kind of land grab where they're damming the water so that the farm downstream doesn't get the water, and they're having arguments in bars about it, and the sheriff's trying to keep the peace. Played by Edward Binns, who appeared in tons and tons of science fiction and horror movies around the time. If you go through his filmography, he was in all sorts of stuff way into the 70s. And good jobbing character actor. John Hoyt's in it, who was in When Worlds Collide, amongst other things, and was also in Flesh Gordon. And in his real...
After the porn motif.
Well, even better, he was a practicing nudist in real life. So, yeah. I
wouldn't have thought it needed that much practice, but...
Well, yes. I assume at some stage you did get it right.
Yes, yes. You know, it's a lifetime of practice.
But I mean, the elephant in the room on this one is Eric Fleming as the hero. He's a local preacher.
Yeah.
And he is a fucking stiff.
He's so dull.
He is so dull.
And I think for a preacher, terribly judgmental...
Yeah, he was, and he kind of wears his cross on his sleeve a little bit. And this guy is so dull that his hand goes to sleep when he masturbates. I mean,
even he bores himself in bed.
Yeah, and Eric Fleming, I looked into his history a little bit because you think somebody who's such a stiff actor, I'm going to do this. He's the only human being in acting history that I know of whose good looks came from him being a fuckwit. And I'm going to explain.
How do you? Let's see the trail there.
World War II, he's in the Navy, right? And his friends dare him to lift a 200 kilo weight over his head. So he lifts a 200 kilo weight over his head and drops it on his own face. Needs extensive plastic surgery because basically it's like that frying pan with a Warner Brothers character when it goes flat. So they rebuilt his face and made him handsome. And that's how his fucking career started. I read that in his obituary in the...
This may explain the stiff acting. I don't know how many of his facial muscles worked.
Yeah, I mean, you get the Jack Palance kind of thing. But yeah, that's why he's got that kind of good-looking nose and the chin and all that. All of it's rebuilt.
What do you do when you don't have Botox? You drop weights on your face.
No, it wasn't 200 kilos. It was 100 kilos. 200 pounds.
Dropping 50 kilos on your face is going to damage your face.
I think doctors recommend that you don't drop any weights above a pillow.
Nine out of ten doctors recommend.
Anything heavier than a pillow, they don't recommend you drop on your face.
Not smashing your face with heavy objects. Yeah. Bless them.
So, and even stranger, he was making a movie in 1966. He was making a movie called High Jungle in Peru. And drowned. He was in a canoe and drowned in a canoe accident.
It's not funny, Terry. It's not funny in the slightest.
Well, funny and unusual. Funny, unusual.
I feel like such a bad person.
I'm sure he was. Yeah, so you're going to giggle anyway.
I'm a bad person and I should feel wrong.
Yeah. So basically, this guy tended to be totally uncoordinated when it came to heavyweights and canoes.
Oh, dear. Poor Eric.
Yes.
And yet, made an acting career.
He did. He was in Rawhide. He was the trail boss for the cattle thing in Rawhide with Clint Eastwood, the famous chair talker.
I know. Like, he's got a pretty immobile face right there, but, you know, at least he can do things with his voice.
Yes, and he never dropped a weight on his head. But it's amazing the deeper you dive into these.
Laughing. That's so
the deeper
bad.
You dive into these people's history in movies, you find out weird stuff. I clicked on the link with a contemporary newspaper headline about his death, and they mentioned this weight dropping on his face. And I thought, I've got to use that. That is just too good not to put into the.
That is excellent. That movie is so superb.
It is, but and Michael Pate steals the movie. You've got to admit, Michael.
Oh, Michael Pate's fantastic.
He is fantastic in the movie, and his Australian accent comes through in a lot of parts.
It's so weird. Whenever I've seen him in Australian films, he always sounds so American. And in fact, I don't know if you've ever seen, let alone reviewed this, but he's in Return of Captain Invincible.
He is.
As the American president. I love that film. For years,
bullshit,
I would tell people,
bullshit, bullshit, bullshit.
It's a musical. Yeah, it is. It's great. But I I for years, would talk about that film and I would get looks because people clearly had never heard of it. And I'm almost certain that Kate Fitzpatrick tried to buy every copy to burn.
Well, yeah, but then I think Umbrella brought it out recently on DVD.
Yes, and that's, you know, I'm excited now because now when I mention it, some people may actually have heard of it.
It's Christopher Lee's best singing role.
It's fabulous. Mm. It's just, it's such a cracky, bizarre film. Highly recommended to everybody everywhere.
Yes, all the time. And particularly for Alan Arkin's very bad wig.
Alan Arkin's very bad everything.
Yeah, he's I don't know whether he was on severe anti-pain medication during that movie, but
I think it was just the script.
Yeah, well, the script was pretty fucked, but yeah,
it's the script and musical by Richard O'Brien from Rocky Horror.
Yeah,
so
and
which
Billy,
may explain
Billy Field,
thing or two.
Who did Bad Habits, wrote one of the songs for it as well. So yeah, we got
it's great.
I tell you what, how about you and I podcast about that in the
we
future?
We should definitely.
We're
going to
do that. We'll do that on an MDip in future. But yeah, back to it. He looks great too. He's got that kind of gunslinger thing. He's got the black vest, the black hat, the spangles.
But
on his
vest. He's even got a sexy walk. He's very much. I was quite surprised to find the anti-hero vampire kind of that early in the films that he starts off quite bad and then he's seeking redemption, but he screws it up because he's not very good at finding redemption. But he's, you know, there seems to be a genuine desire that he wants to stop eating people because he's fallen in love.
Yeah.
But, you know, so he's got that sultriness. And, you know, I've never thought of Michael Pate as sexy before, but I thought he'd, you know, he said, well, maybe it's just been compared to Eric Fleming.
Yeah. Well, that's
because, you know, frankly, a fence post was looking quite attractive at that point.
Yeah, I mean, and Michael Pate started out in Australian film, Sons of Matthew in the 1940s and films like that. And then he went to the US as a character actor. He was in The Court Jester with Danny Kaye.
Oh, the Danny Kaye film.
Yeah, if you look at that, he's one of the henchmen that the bad guy has. So, yeah, Michael Pate, and we all like any Australian actor in a Hollywood film. I mean, Rod Taylor built his whole career on being an Australian actor in Hollywood films. They're doing a documentary about Rod Taylor, too.
Oh, really?
The same guys who did Not Quite Hollywood.
Oh, excellent.
Interviewing him and doing a doco on his career. So I look forward to that in future, too.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that'll be good. So, anyway, yeah, Pate is good, and I actually found his interpretation of the character, because I wasn't expecting much of this film. Vampire Western, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
But, you know, I found it much more morally ambiguous.
Yeah,
Including the fact that we were talking about Buffer as the bad guy rancher, but you know, he dammed the river, but only for a short while because he was trying to make a little and then he undammed it again. So he was a prick, but he wasn't the evil bastard necessarily. There was ambiguity in his behaviour, and he gets blamed for a lot of these deaths that aren't really his fault. And one of the deaths that he did cause, the other guy drew first. He shot in self-defense. Yeah. So there's that ambiguity there about how bad he is as a bad guy.
Which makes the movie better than it should be.
Yeah, yeah, it lifts its game right up.
And there's that really nice bit at the start where the priest has been looking after this girl who's got the disease they think that people have.
The wasting disease.
The
gender-specific wasting disease.
Yeah, and they and they kind of leave the room in the morning and to have a break and get something to eat because he's been sitting up all night with her. And then they hear a scream and they come back in the room and the roller blind on the window is going 300 miles an hour because something's come in bitter and just leapt out the window again. That's quite nicely done. I like that bit. And again, it's something that you don't expect in a movie of this kind of caliber because it was low budget. It was probably a second feature in a drive-in circuit or something like that. But it does have virtues. Unfortunately, the film doesn't have a DVD release that I know of. The copy that we've got is a VHS rip. But I'd recommend it, whoever's got the rights to it, make it. Do it a DVD release, even if you double it with another movie.
I mean, it's quite intriguing. We were mentioning a little earlier during our break that Dolores, she's the daughter of the doctor who is killed.
Yep.
And then her brother, Tim, is shot.
Yeah.
And so she's left all alone, and she's blaming Buffer for the deaths of both men.
Yeah.
And like I said, Tim was shot by Buffer, but in self-defense. Her father was actually killed by a vampire, but she doesn't know that. So she's blaming Buffer. So, you know, she bamps the shit out of that stuff.
Yeah.
And a badass motherfucker, she goes, all right, I'm a woman left all alone in the world. Clearly what I need to do is hire a gunslinger.
Yeah.
I'm nailing up posts all over. I don't know what was going on in the law in that town at the time, that you couldn't arrest someone for conspiring to commit murder.
Yeah.
But it was just, oh, she can put the posters up, but we can't do anything until somebody's actually dead.
Yeah.
But I like the fact that she just kept arguing with the wooden preacher man, saying, you can't do that, it's bad. And she's going, my family's dead, screw you. and keeps putting the posters up. So, you know, the fact that she's decided that she's not going to be a victim, she's going to do something. The fact that she's actually morally wrong, actually she's blaming someone who's not at fault, again, it lifts it out of...
She's making assumptions about it too.
Yeah. So that lifts it out of...
And this movie's got what I call the Masala complex in it too. The Masala complex is, you know, in Ben-Hur, when Masala and Ben-Hur have the chariot race. Every time I see that movie, I want Stephen Boyd to win the chariot race. And in this movie, I wanted the vampire gunslinger to beat the sanctimonious, tight-ass preacher. And he does it, of course, because it's that kind of movie. But it would have been really nice if he did. I reckon
that
would
have... In fact, it ends quite abruptly. I wasn't really happy with the ending.
No, I think that they got to their running time and just kind of cut it there. It's not an A film in anything. I think a remake would be great. I think a remake.
It would. And it's all that moral ambiguity. Because there's shows that you get now with things like Dexter and... there's shows where you're going, oh, watch out, you know, person who does terrible things, you might get caught. Oh, that's right, you're supposed to get caught. You do terrible things. And I actually really enjoy the... that moral clash that you get while you're watching things. And this one, the fact that, yes, as the vampire, he's responsible for the death of her father and the death of all those girls, but partway through that film he's going, actually, I don't want to do that anymore. I'm in love and I want to be better than that. So he makes that attempt, and then at the end he goes, I want to be better than that, but I won't. Yeah. And it's like, that was a shame. So that's the other thing about the
vampire gunslinger. He's not particularly fast. He doesn't have to be a fast gunslinger. All he has to do is shoot.
Because people shoot him all the time.
People shoot him all the time. It doesn't do anything. And he
can't kill something that's already dead. So he doesn't care about being fastest.
No.
So that look of surprise on his face at the end was quite charming.
Yeah, it was. But on the other hand, the preacher cheated.
He did cheat.
Yeah, cheating little bugger. And but the movie... I wasn't expecting much when I heard about this Vampire Western. I thought, I'll take a look at it. And it's got Michael Peet in it, so it's worth a look anyway. And we do have that parochialism as an Australian movie buff, that anything with an Australian actor in it will at least give it a go. But yeah, I think Michael Peet really did bring an A-game to this movie. He brought more to it than it deserved in some ways.
He brought actually subtlety, which most of the others did not have any of that, including Dolores. She wasn't particularly subtle, and her brother Tim certainly wasn't. You did get the sense of this vampire who's...
conflicted.
Yeah, surprised, like he didn't ask. And there's at one point he's having that argument. He says, I didn't ask for this. This was done to me.
Yeah, and
I was turned into a vampire. I didn't choose this. And, I need to survive.
Yeah.
What do you want from me?
And also the origin of the vampire is a little bit unusual too. It's kind of like God didn't like what he did, so God made him a vampire. I mean, that's the basic storyline of it. He killed his brother. And basically he was cursed with being a vampire. Who cursed him? The guy who the preacher follows.
Yeah. So it's, like I said, the what lifts it really up out of the ordinary is the fact that it is so much moral ambiguity in what's going on. And you've got this deadly dull priest who's, as you say, is very sanctimonious and quite dull. You've got Dolores who understand her rage at, the deaths of these members of the family, and Buffer may not be a murderer, but he is a dick.
He is.
Right, and there's all this stuff going on. I was expecting it to be so much more predictable and so much, Westerns do this, so it's going to have these kind of stereotypes and this kind of trope. And I just felt it was just twisting all the tropes a little bit. And then you get this vampire who's Drake, who's quite sensitive, really.
Yeah.
And I thought he did a really good job of starting off quite cold and then going, there's a little bit more. And he seems quite... certainly much more reasonable a person than Buffer, despite the fact that he's eating people.
Yeah. And the weird thing is, Buffer's got all of his henchmen around him. It's like he likes hanging out with guys a little bit too. So there could be a subtext there. There's no woman in his life, really. And it doesn't particularly have an interest in women. But he doesn't like it when his men don't do the right thing.
Yes, I think he sacks one for failing to...
Yeah, he does.
Properly shoot the gunslinger.
And you think, if it was the 21st century, you'd be hanging out in Castro Street or something like that. But, it's an interesting little film. Nowhere near perfect. But it's got enough... I think one of the virtues of it is the oddity of it. It really does have that weirdness, which makes it the kind of thing that you and I and other people like in a film. Even though they didn't have money for it, they didn't have big stars for it. They had a leading man who was basically a totem pole and a villain who a jobbing actor, Michael Pateny. He never had an enormous career. He had a lot more respect in Australia because he went on to produce a few things like The Mango Tree and other things like that, but really brought something different to the vampire roles.
Well, he had so much texture, and he had so much more texture than... But, you know, I mean, having said that, and I found Dolores a little disappointing, you know, I did find her in the end just, you know, she was more... than just the weak little woman. You know, I mean, like she hired a gunslinger, for goodness sake. You know, there was a bit of prevarication and back and forth with her, partly as a result of her being under Drake's sway a little bit. But, you know, she had more oomph to her than
well, have a look at the town she's in. Everybody else is either a stiff-looking preacher or middle-aged guys, and she's a young woman. So, of course, somebody comes along wearing black and being charming and being helpful. There's going to be an attraction there. He doesn't have to do the vampire kind of ensorcelment to her.
And even when he's talking about being a gunslinger, he sets himself up as very honourable. That he investigates the issue before he decides he's going to take the job. And
that's probably an influence of Have Gun Will Travel with Richard Boone playing Paladin, who was basically a gun for hire, but he had his own moral code. So that was very much a trope in the late 50s.
Pass that onto a vampire character. Again, they were just playing with the ideas quite a lot, and they said, although it falls short of its potential, I found rather than being bored or rather than just roaring with laughter from start to finish at the incompetence of it all, I was actually really, really interested to see what was going to happen next, because it didn't do things that I expected it to do.
I did get overtired of the theremin. Every time he showed up. I mean, do it 3 or 4 times, but don't do it 6, 7, or 8 times. So every time Drake turns up, you got the theremin music. And we go, yes, we can see he's turned up. You can ease up on the theremins.
Yes, but, you know, just in case you've missed, the man in black is there.
I'll try to dub in some of the theremin music for this, because it is very much something that happened in Universal. Universal seems to be the only mob who really did it. At the time, I may be wrong and people will probably correct me, but it was really a universal trope to use theremins and things like that in these movies.
Just have visions of the music department, so we bought this goddamn thing, we're going to use it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it doesn't make milkshakes, it doesn't make cocktails, we might as well use it for this.
It just does one job.
Yeah, unlike an iPhone app. But anyway, that's about it for Curse of the Undead. I think we both recommend it. People should check it out. It's an interesting and laterally different vampire film. And it's got an Australian in it, which is always a virtue.
Indeed.
Okay.
Yeah. So, it was good.
Okay, so we'll take another break. And when we come back, we'll do a little bit of Malkovich and Dafoe, Shadow of the Vampire, which has got a lot of movie type of stuff in it, apart from being a vampire movie. And we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Yeah.
Roll camera. Iris in. Begin.
It's been a fitful night, but you wake refreshed. What is that beside you? It's a book. About vampires.
Nosferatu. Director F.W. Murnau had an obsession to create the world's most realistic vampire movie.
Meet Count Orlok.
An overture to our symphony of horrors.
He dug up an actor.
I'd like some makeup.
Well, you don't get any.
Who didn't just play the part.
But you're not feeding.
No, you're not drinking her blood.
He lived it.
What is the matter with you?
Where did you find him, really?
From Lionsgate Films and producer Nicolas Cage comes the haunting tale of the uncompromising.
You will have no close-ups now.
The unimaginable.
Blood! Blood!
And the undead. Academy Award nominees John Malkovich.
I will finish my picture!
And Willem Dafoe.
This is hardly your picture any longer.
Shadow of the Vampire.
How dare you destroy my photographer!
Why not the script girl?
I'll eat her later.
Okay, and we're back, and we're talking about Shadow of the Vampire from 2000, a movie that was produced by Nicolas Cage. And you have a certain opinion about Nicolas Cage, don't you?
I'm just saying I really wish he'd stick to producing films, because every time he acts in them, they're dogs. They're just... I keep trying so hard to like films that he's in. The last film he was in that I actually liked was Peggy Sue Got Married, and that was probably despite his performance.
Yeah, he's in Drive Angry too, and I kind of like that, mostly for the other character actors in it.
I tried watching Ghost Rider because, you know, we'd been past where some of it was filmed in Melbourne.
Yeah, in Melbourne, yeah.
And we were Melbourne spotting, basically. But we got halfway through the film and realised we didn't care what happened to anybody and that life was short and we possibly had time.
Well, they filmed the end of that out near my place, out in the hills just west of Werribee. And there's another one of his too, that science fiction one.
Knowing,
yeah.
See, I sort of wanted to see that because a friend of mine was an extra in that. And basically, I just want a pizza spot.
The big truck hitting the car accident was about half a kilometre from my house. And the aeroplane crash was a kilometre and a half the other way from my house.
Oh, well, there you go. So, like you see, he obviously likes Australia. Thank you, Mr. Cage, if you're listening, for providing work for the Australian film industry. But please stop acting.
Yeah, and it takes you out of the movie, though, when you go, okay, I drive that place where the planes crashing. I drive past that every night. So it takes you well out of the movie.
Because one of the places they actually filmed an explosion in, I think what was meant to be a truck lot, was just a couple of streets away from here. So we went past when it was done up as the lot, and then we went past a few days later after it had been blown up. And frankly, the only two characters who were thought were worth watching in the half the film that we watched, there was some old guy living in a cemetery, and I thought, you've done C-grade films before, but you do it with conviction. I quite like you. And Rebel Wilson just had this pop-up little part saying, oh, and his face is on fire, and Rebel Wilson's quite, she's funny.
Yeah,
she's
she is good value. Woman. And that's the weird thing. That's a couple of streets where all the motorcycle, we're in the Melbourne city now recording in the Rails flat, and one of my other friends, who you know, told me that one of those motorcycle places is actually a front for a heroin distribution
business. Wouldn't be surprised.
So, interesting thing. And
as I was just saying a moment ago, you've got to have the vices of a big city because otherwise it's so discouraging for the big city.
And small town vices tend to involve livestock and sex with your relatives, so they're all a bit dull.
Ew. Ew.
Yes, I know. Which one are you going ooh about? Buzz? Oh,
all of them, really.
Yeah. I mean, it just shows no imagination at all. But back to the movie.
Back to the film.
Okay, Shadow of the Vampire. Basically, this one's a bit of a conceit. The conceit being that Max Schreck, who played the Count Orlok in Nosferatu, Murnau's 1922 film, was actually a vampire that Murnau got to do the role. Now, in real life, Max Schreck was a jobbing actor who died of a heart attack in 1936 and did a lot of stage work and did something like 30-odd movies in real life, none of them looking like this because the makeup, of course, is very iconic. But there are some true aspects to this as well. It was an adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula done after Mrs. Stoker said, no, you can't have the film right. So they went, okay, we'll change the names. And we'll just do it anyway. And they did that. And there was a court case in England to keep the movie out of England because of that, because Bram Stoker's widow, who this movie was probably her only cash flow, or the book was her only cash flow, was very protective of it and didn't want the movie to be made. She dropped off the twig before Universal did Dracula, of course, which was of great benefit to Bela Lugosi, amongst other people. But Murnau was an interesting director. I'm actually getting a copy of his best film, apart from Nosferatu, which is Sunrise. It's a movie, silent movie he did in Hollywood before he died. And I've seen little bits of it in Martin Scorsese documentaries about the history of cinema, but I really want to see the movie. And you can get it at archive.org.
Okay.
It's public domain. It's a silent film.
Sunrise. Okay.
Sunrise. And it's worth checking out. But Murnau himself was a weird bugger. He was he was openly gay at a time when it was quite dangerous to be openly gay, particularly in Germany. Went to Hollywood, made this movie. Died in a car accident on the Pacific Coast Highway. There are two stories about this. Either way, the car was being driven by his 14-year-old Filipino houseboy. One of the theories is that he was giving the houseboy a blowjob at the time, and that's why they crashed, and that's why Murnau died.
Sorry, much more inappropriate laughing at the unfortunate death of others.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think this has got to be the unfortunate death episode of MD.
Because, I mean, you're talking about a 14-year-old Filipino there. So I'm assuming he was short as well as not old enough to have had a license. So, like, you have an unlicensed short driver who can't see over the dash and you're blowing him at the same time.
Yeah.
Generally not a good recipe for safe arrival at one's destination.
Absolutely. And other thing was, Murnau himself was 6'11". So just folding yourself under that dashboard is probably a bit problematic there.
There is so much wrong in that. I mean, starting from, he's a 14-year-old kid. What the fuck are you thinking of? But, you know,
well,
it's just,
exactly what he was thinking of. But
there was no thought at all in any step of that process.
Interesting guy, though, Myrna. World War One fighter pilot. Crashed a number of times, didn't get hurt.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was like buddies with the Red Baron.
Maybe he was trusting in his luck with hurtling objects.
Well, after that, so there's not too many World War One flying aces who made movies and then died giving a blowjob, as far as I know.
Now, I'm sure if there is more than one, there is a list somewhere on the internet.
There probably is. So if somebody can send us a link to famous people who died giving hummers, we'll put it up on the website. But yeah, so that's Murnau. And it's nothing like the Murnau we have in this film.
No.
This Murnau is Malkovich being outrageous and kind of Teutonically dictatorial and scholarly and bossy and wearing
the artistic vision.
Yeah, and all that kind of thing.
Very Machiavellian.
Yeah, very Machiavellian. And not 6'11".
No.
Yeah.
He can't act himself tall.
No. You can do it now with CGI. If you can turn people into hobbits and dwarves, you can definitely make
John Malkovich. Scrawny guys into Captain America or vice versa.
Well, yes, you can do all that kind of stuff. So the technology is there. We can rebuild them. But not at this time. And the other people in the cast are great. Dafoe's Shrek / Orlok / Nameless Vampire is fantastic. He does have the mannerisms that Shrek showed in Nosferatu, but he does elaborate on them. The bit with the long fingernails and the scraping noise he makes with his long fingernails.
And that wonderful scene where the two of the crew who just think he's a method actor taking it all a bit too seriously.
He worked with Stanislavski.
And, yes, and he'd worked with Stanislavski in Russia. Oh, the Russians. And ask him what he thought of the book, and he expresses his what impressed him most, the sorrow for him, is that that Dracula didn't have servants, and they're all going, what?
Yeah.
And then he did this beautiful extrapolation of this idea that here's this ancient vampire.
I think I'll put the clip in for this because it's worth doing, and it does show you the beauty of this film, even though it wasn't a big film, it wasn't particularly popular.
Well, it's not funny anymore.
Come on, Count Dracula wouldn't say he couldn't remember.
I read that book. Murnau gave it to me.
Well, now this is a golden opportunity. Speaking as a vampire, what do you make of the book's technical merits?
It made me sad.
Why sad?
Because Dracula had no servants.
I think you missed the point of the book, Count Orlok.
Dracula hasn't had servants in 400 years, and then a man comes to his ancestral home, and he must convince him that he is like the man. He has to feed him, when he himself hasn't eaten food in centuries. Can he even remember how to buy bread? How to select cheese and wine. And then he remembers the rest of it. How to prepare a meal, how to make a bed. He remembers his past glory, his armies, his retainers, and what he is reduced to. The loneliest part of the book comes when the man accidentally sees Dracula setting his table.
I saw it when it came out in the cinema, in one of those little art house ones they have attached to the big cinemas, like Cinema Europa or whatever they call it, with my mate Jamie Royal. We were the only two people in the cinema watching this, so we could talk our way through the movie and go, oh, shit, this is good.
Your very own Mystery Theatre 3000.
Well, yeah, a little bit of that, but mostly we were kind of lost in admiration with Defoe's acting.
Defoe is amazing. I mean, he's a very well-respected stage actor, and he's got that weird face, but his control over his body and his voice, and he has always been able to take roles that shouldn't be playable and make them perfect. He's good.
And in this too, he's got that thing with his face where the vampire has obviously lived by himself for a very, very, very long time, and he's lost the skill of hiding his thoughts from his face. So everything he thinks and every little nuance of thought is in his face, and that's great acting by Defoe, but it's also very good for the character. The character has lost that ability to mask his thoughts.
He's actually surprisingly naive and almost sweet, except for the fact that he's trying to kill people.
Yes,
because he's actually turns out to be quite excited to be making a film, and when he sees that everyone else is getting makeup, he wants makeup, and he wants to be treated like a star. You know, it's like this is his first human contact in a really long time, and all of a sudden these quite normal human urges for recognition and for people to be nice to him start emerging, and like even though he's weird as fuck, you know, it's a beautifully
like
nuanced.
It's a little like the Mexican extras in Bowfinger, who they just get off a truck and to make the movie with, and they get them to be the cameraman and the lighting guy and all that kind of thing. And halfway through, they're already in Cahiers de Cinema and talking about focal lengths and things like that. He's a little bit like that. He's a quick study on the movies. And he recognises the main actress, Greta, when he sees her picture. So he may have slipped into a cinema or two or something like that, or at least done a bit of research.
Skulking around in the dark.
Well, cinemas are the perfect place.
I must admit, I had assumed when he saw that he knew of this actress, so he knew that she was a famous and beautiful person, and that was the first time he'd seen her as quite captive, so he knew her name because of the negotiations he'd undertaken.
Yeah. Played by Catherine McCormack, and the character, when he meets her, is basically a fucked up junkie. She's a Lindsay Lohan of the silent era. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And when he meets her, when Orlok meets her, and he's trying to be all ingratiating, and he's just terrifying. But like I said, there's this naivete about it as well that's almost painfully... You almost feel sorry for him, even though he's creepy and is up to no good. He said, like, there's this painful shyness almost, and he's trying so hard to make a good impression, and he's just... just so creepy.
And he's hungry too. I mean, he basically, you know, asks if they can lose the writer. They don't need the writer now, the script's written. And, you know, do they need the cameraman kind of thing?
Who am I allowed to eat?
Who am I allowed to eat?
Who's unnecessary?
Which is why you have extras in movies, I assume, you know, just basically
in case you have a vampire on the crew.
vampire milkshake. But it's a very funny film too. You really can't lose the fact that it's hilariously funny.
So in fact, it's a little hard to know sometimes how to take it, because you sit there, is it a serious film? Is it a send-up? And of course, it's sort of both, because it's trying to say, well, if this was really the case, and you've got these rather odd characters. So basically, the vampire's behaviour, trying to pretend to be a person pretending to be a vampire, there's a lot of comic potential there, but it's curiously bittersweet. Like I said, that sense of him being naive and actually being a bit used, though he's using other people, and the director's clearly crazy.
Yeah.
You know, so the humour is always sort of there's this undertow of it's actually kind of sad as well as bizarre.
But also the whole cast of theatrical type people, so they're used to eccentricity, and they kind of accept the fact that he's method, and he sleeps in a coffin, and he's only seen at night when he's in makeup,
and they just roll their eyes and go, oh, these Russians. And of course, one of the things they do, which I really enjoy, and it reminded me of a couple of other things, but you know, they'll say, well, we want panic in this sequence, so the film the cameraman is there, he starts filming and goes, oh, we need to have more of a reaction here. So he fires gunshots into the air and then keeps filming, because that gets the reaction that he wants. And it reminded me of two things. One was there was a TV series called Drop the Dead Donkey, and there's a sequence in that where they're trying to film in a war zone, but it's quite a long way away from the shooting. They go, oh, we're not getting a sense of panic. This is not really working. So there's the reporter going, hang on a second, to the cameraman, and lobs a grenade somewhere into the camp. And there's screaming and running around. So that looks much more impressive for news television. So that's the first thing it reminded me
of. If it bleeds, it leads. Yeah.
And the other film it reminded me of is there's a 1980 film called The Stuntman.
Yeah.
Where there's
Peter O'Toole, Steve Railsback.
Yes, yes. And so you've got O'Toole as this director who keeps doing... The real life and fantasy keep interweaving. You're not always sure when something's real and when something's for the camera. And often the O'Toole's character is making real things. So he's, rather than relying on people being good actors, he's doing real life things to produce the effects that he wants when he's filming them. And so that's another thing. It's the whole thing about Shadow of the Vampire is so metatextual in that sense, that it's a film not just about... This vampire sort of wreaking havoc amongst this crew of this vampire film and this crazy director. But it's actually about the process of making films. It's about the process of people being so obsessed about creating reality in art, so that in fact they're doing reality in art. They're filming real things, which seems to be missing the point of pretending. But
yeah. And there's a long history of asshole directors in cinema. I mean, going back to Bad and the Beautiful and 2 Weeks in Another Town, you've got Stuntman. You get any number of movies, and I think writers like to make movies where the director's a real cunt. And sorry if that offends you, but it happens.
No.
Yeah. But yeah, basically that's it. And there's a, it goes along with that. But there's that beautiful conceit. We know pretty much from the start that he's a vampire. There's no pretending that he's not. It's not really a spoiler to tell people that. But Defoe's fantastically good in this film. And I really do like the fact that they, again, like Curse of the Undead, they've got a different spin on vampires. And they've done it really, really well. And, I mean, I could almost see his vampire in one of your books as one of the vampires skulking around the shadows.
He's a sad, feeble character who's been denuded of his power and his confidence, and he's just this useless dead guy.
Yeah, but
he's dangerous, but there's no glamour to him. He's just a sad, sorry bastard who's lost in the world and has been alone for a long time. So he's actually pitiful more than he is frightening.
But then there is that frightening bit where Murnau grabs him by the lapels and bends him over. And he slowly straightens himself just to show how strong he is. And then he starts to have a realization that these people are really kind of weak and aren't as strong as him and don't have certain abilities and powers that he has. So he remembers who and what he is. He remembers who and what he is because he's been living. He doesn't remember how old he is. He doesn't remember how he became a vampire.
He can't remember where he's from. Because that's in that scene where they're asking him about his method acting, and he doesn't remember any of that stuff. I'm assuming they think that he's just decided that that's what this character's like. But he's, you know, it's actually quite sad because he doesn't. He's so old and so removed from his humanity, he doesn't remember anything.
And that's beautifully portrayed by Defoe. It makes it incredibly believable that this is an ancient parasite who lives there and suddenly is thrown into a slightly weird 20th century world where artificial lighting can be as bright as daylight. And there's that bit where he's looking through the Victrola and sees a sunrise for the first time.
For the first time in who knows how long.
And it's, that's a beautiful scene. And
it's a little heartbreaking, actually, the look on his little face.
Yeah.
And it's beautifully balanced as a performance. And like, I have to say, Eddie Izzard. I really like, because if you're looking at the original Nosferatu, the heroic character, the husband, he just comes across as a just a
dick.
Yeah. Oh no, not a even just a Wally. He comes across as a Wally.
A bit of a pudgy Wally in a sense, isn't he? Yeah.
So, but Izzard manages to both convey the Walliness, but also the fact that this Wally isn't. You are getting the sense of him being afraid, and so he's actually being. Izzard is portraying the real actor with his real emotions and this very heightened, much less subtle acting of the character in a silent film. And he's doing both those things, which I think is really astonishing.
And the other cool thing about the film, too, is it's got Udo Kier in it playing the producer. And Udo Kier, of course, was Dracula in Blood for Dracula, the Warhol film. So, and he's got a long history in genre cinema, right up to Iron Sky. And I always like Udo Kier in movies. I don't think he's particularly a great actor, but he's got a certain niche that he populates very well in cinema.
Yeah, some people, they get by on having a really strong screen charisma and doing a particular type of thing really, really well. Sean Connery's made an entire career out of that. So.
Now, there are a couple of roles where he tried to do other things. I've talked about him in paleo cinema, things like The Hill and A Fine Madness, where he was always trying to get outside that box of being a tough bastard. He plays a mad poet in A Fine Madness, and he plays a professional soldier in The Hill. And there are some roles before he, towards the end of his career, started cashing checks so he could go and play golf, but where he really did try other things. And even the Oscar-winning role in The Untouchables is pretty much a Connery tough old bastard role.
It must be hard sometimes. And sometimes it's hard to get the... Sometimes an actor needs the right kind of director as well as the right kind of material to shift out of where they've had a bit more.
But they get very protective of their image as well, which is the problem, that they won't take those risks. I mean, people who start out as stage actors tend to be a bit more risk-friendly. People who started out doing TV and cinema tend to be risk averse. Biggest case of that being Tom Cruise. Won't do anything that goes outside his persona. Always got to run in every movie except Born on the 4th of July. And that kind of weird protecting your brand kind of thing. Where I love movies where actors
I don't know how much of that too is folded in on directors not wanting to give them a chance to do something different because they believe that the viewers won't give them that chance. And you look at somebody like Brendan Fraser, who's made a career out of those sort of cheesy action films, things like George of the Jungle, but then who did Gods and Monsters, who's like, I've done one film that proves I can act and that I'm awesome, now back to George of the Jungle. And it's like, I always feel a little disappointed.
Yeah, and I love it when actors try to, even if they're not successful, where they try to step out of those self-imposed stereotypes. And again, it is up to their choice which roles they take. Nobody's holding a gun at their head telling them to make Mission Impossible 12 or anything like that. It's a choice they make. One of the things, and also one of the things you notice in cinema is actors will go back to a franchise when their other movies fail. You get a string of kind of mediocre films from people, and Cruise did a few of them as well. And then suddenly they go, okay, well, I know the franchise is going to make $500 million, so I'll do that again and I'll make another franchise film. And, you know, again, that's my retirement income. But you can always tell when things like Will Smith, whole string of really shit movies, went back to Men in Black because he knew it would make money. And he wanted to keep his status at that certain level. And, I mean, there must be an enormous insecurity. I mean, for me, if I was an actor, and this is because I'm a poor person, first time I made $20 million, I'd quit and just cruise the South Seas in a yacht with lots of coconut drinks. But these guys, they want to maintain that prestige, and it's an interesting thing.
And it can be hard for writers too, just in a slightly different way, that people expect a certain kind of book or another book in that series, and that may not be what the writer wants to do. Hence that famous Neil Gaiman comment to somebody on his blog saying, George R.R. Martin hasn't done the next chapter of this book, he owes me. And Gaiman's responsive, George R.R. Martin is not your bitch.
That's it.
And, it can be a challenge for a lot of people in anything that the public is engaging with or having a relationship with, that they want more of the same. Or, it can be a bit challenging.
And also, there's a thing back with actors as far back as the 40s and 50s, pretty much after the studio system, where they'll do one for themselves and one for the studio. So they'll tell the studio, I want to do this small character piece, but I will do your big blockbustery bang bang explosion movie if you let me do this other one. And there's a long string of that. I mean, people like Robert Mitchum did it, Kirk Douglas did it, a whole bunch, and even female actors did it as well, where they kind of do one for themselves, where they wanted to stretch their muscles and exercise and try something different. And then they do one for the stereotype. And I kind of respect that more than people who just
make
things that aren't too much out of their comfort zone, but they're unsuccessful, like Will Smith does, playing the usual action things like Hancock.
Because, I don't know if they're trying and nobody's letting them. I honestly just don't know. And I know that there are some actors who then go, well, look, I'll fund something, a little
I think it is. They define success by the box office all the time. Now, if you're an actor, you do a small film worth $20 million, half of which is your pay, and it makes $40 million. That's a successful film, but it's not as successful as your enormous genre films, and that's where some of these guys trip up. They assume that if they make a small film and it does well, their measurement stick is not appropriate to the movie.
Yeah, you can't just look at the dollar figure. You've got to look at the relative percentages.
We're drifting around, but this is okay. I don't mind us drifting around.
We can get back.
We will get back.
Because this is all about Udo, and we love you, Udo.
Yeah, Udo Kier, absolutely lovely character actor, and I would have him over for dinner.
And frankly, Gary Elwes gets stuck on that same.
Yeah.
I actually find it really hard to take him seriously as an actor whenever he's doing a dramatic role, because Princess Bride is constantly in my head. He was in the first Saw film. That was actually really, really good.
It was
psychodrama. And he was very good at that. And I think he put a lot of good work in. I believed him in that. But my first thing is always like
Princess Bride,
and some of the other comedies that he did, and there's always that little bit of work that I have to do at the beginning in a dramatic role. But usually I find if he's playing dramatic roles, he's playing bastards.
Yeah. It's nice playing a bastard. I mean, I'm sure it's very therapeutic to play a real total bastard in a film when everybody loves you and everything else you do. I mean, there's a little bit of that with Robin Williams playing things like, you know, 1 hour photo and things like that, where he steps out and steps outside that comfort zone.
Yeah. But and people, I'm one of those people, I don't really much like Jim Carrey's comedies, but I love his dramas.
Yeah, Jim Carrey is problematic for me because that mugging really does alienate.
When he's got that's why I felt like in a lot of the dramatic films, if he's got a director who's really keeps him on a tight rein, he does really, really good work. I really enjoyed The Number 23 and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
I did enjoy Eternal Sunshine. Gondry was great, and it did keep him under control because the story was about what was happening and the portraying of what was happening, not the character.
And what was the one about Man on the Moon, the life of that
Comedian? Andy Kaufman. Yeah, Man on the Moon.
So again, I think he did a really, really good job of that. So I think, you know, it's one of those things that can be quite difficult, but I don't generally find his comedies very... I find the unrestrained nature that he's always just going on. Let's pull it back a bit, Jim.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Comedy, I mean, that's the problem with a lot of the Judd Apatow movies. They're getting too long these days, those Judd Apatow comedies, because people go, you made a lot of money, we'll let you do what you like. No, you've got to kind of have somebody saying, no, you're being self-indulgent.
George Lucas the man.
Well, yes, but then George Lucas was never a particularly good filmmaker. He just kind of had lightning strike once and has been playing.
Then they just let him go, and what do you get? You get Jar Jar Binks.
George Lucas is the Catholic Church of cinema. He got people when they were young, and he's hooked them for life. And yeah, you know, of course, he hasn't done a number of the bad things that the Catholic Church does, as far as I know, but he's got that kind of, you know, have them, get them when they're five and keep them for life kind of stuff happening.
Yeah.
And
maybe he's the McDonald's.
Well, at least McDonald's varies their product now and then. They put some new things on the menu and Lucas doesn't.
We're
not
all being very harsh and judgmental, aren't we?
Yeah, well, that's what podcasting is all about. But anyway, so wrapping it up for Shadow of the Vampire, definitely recommend it. It's out on DVD. People can pick it up. I don't know if it's out on Blu-ray yet, but it's
It plays so well with the format because it actually uses that concept of the slides to tell you what's going on in scenes that you don't see, just like the original silent film does. So it's playing with the Nosferatu film. It's playing with all that meta-text stuff about making films and the way that people, and particularly the vampires, reacting to this very modern thing. And it's, you know, your loyalties are swayed because it's not just a black and white who's good and who's evil. There's complexity, moral complexity.
And one of the other good aspects of it too is just looking at the film technology of the time as it's portrayed in the film, the cameras and all the other bit where you got to hand crank them. The studios, the fact that the director's talking the actors through what they're doing all the way through the film. And also at the start, you've got that beautiful Art Nouveau title sequence.
And like, there's just so much to love in the film. It rewards rewatching, I think, because there's
not too often, but every couple of years or a few years.
As a movie double with Nosferatu.
Well, yes, you could definitely do that. And why stop at two? That's always my theory when you're having a good run on cinemas.
Exactly.
So that's about it for that one. Narelle, thank you for coming on to the Martian Driving Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You've lifted the game. And I did want to make sure that I did get you one. I didn't want the Martian Driving just to be science fiction cinema. I wanted to have horror and fantasy and other things in it as well. And you've contributed a lot. So here's your chance. Spruik your business again.
Oh, well, if you've enjoyed listening to me today, you might like to read my books or download my smartphone apps. So NarelleMHarris.com is my website, and you can find out about my vampire fiction and my crime fiction. And you know, I have some Melbourne-based apps, including Melbourne Peculiar, that just tells you a lot about weird shit you can find around Melbourne, which is fun.
And there is weird shit around Melbourne. There's a lot of it. And I'd also like to thank Petra for putting up with this, Narelle and Tim's cat.
Very well behaved and hasn't bitten anybody. So.
No, well, Petra's never bitten me when I've come over. Petra and I get on fine. So thanks a lot for that, Narelle. And I'll be back after this when I'm back at home with the feedback. And really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, I'm back at home now, and it's time for the feedback. One of the things I should say is that we now have a Martian Drive-In Yahoo group. So that's really cool, and I enjoy having that. I haven't been there too much, but I don't mind people chatting around. I do get the email, so I will be doing that. Now, I really have to thank Nick Sauer for setting up the group. If you want the URL, I will post it. But it's movies.groups.yahoo.com/group /Martian Drive-In, one word. I'll post the link on the marsdrivein.blogspot.com website. But thanks for that, Nick. I haven't had much action on it at the moment, but I do want to get it going and making people aware of it. Join up, have a chat, and we'll have a bit of fun with it. I've got a poll on there at the moment, which I don't like the results on, so please more people vote. And the other thing you can do, and I don't know whether I mentioned this last time, if you go to marsdrivein.blogspot.com, on the right-hand side there's a widget that will let you leave a voicemail message using the microphone on your computer or headset or whatever you've got. So you can do that directly, which is kind of cool. I also have one on the Paleo Cinema site now, and it just makes it a little bit easier than going through and dialing up the K7 phone number I've got. So it may save you a couple of bucks if you want to leave audio feedback. Always happy to grab it. And I do get a little bit of a thrill every time I get a notification that there's a new piece of feedback. Now let me have a look here on the Martian Drive-In. Got a nice little brief one from Vince over at the B-MovieCast. Vince has been an incredible supporter of this podcast, and I try to be a good supporter of his podcast as well. It's a four-letter voicemail, not a four-letter voicemail, but a four-letter email, and it says, Martian Drive-In rocks. And so does B-MovieCast, Vince. You guys have been doing some great stuff, and the ensemble works incredibly well for you. At this stage, I'm just going to keep to two people because it would get too confusing and I wouldn't get as much of a say as I do now. But I appreciate that, particularly coming from somebody who's incredibly gifted at building a podcast community and doing a podcast. You guys have done over 200 now, and it just blows me away. I did get an email from Rickster. Like that, and Rickster, thanks a lot for that. It says, Hi Terry, again I must apologise for my lack of comments lately, but I'm still listening and enjoying both podcasts. Congratulations once again on the launch of Martian Drive-In. The latest podcast with Ian Mon co-hosting is probably my favourite. You and he had a wonderful rapport, and I hope to hear him back again soon. As usual, you mentioned several films which I'm dying to see. Of course, both FAQ About Time Travel and The Extraordinary Adventures of Adele Blanc-Sec are not available here in the States yet, so I'll have to wait and suffer without them. However, I am looking forward to seeing both The Raid and Primer, which you discussed at length in the latest podcast. It's nothing like a good time travel movie, and this one sounds like a gem. I really like to focus on science fiction films off the beaten path. Lack of availability only makes the film sweeter once I've tracked them down. Keep up the great podcasting here and on Paleo Cinema. All the best, Rickster, a.k.a. Serps. Thanks for that, Rickster. You've really got to get into BitTorrent. You'll be able to find these things a little bit easier. If they're not available in your area, it's not really your fault. So you can kind of do a guilt-free download using BitTorrent if you've got the bandwidth for that. And I do recommend you try to have it. I did pass on that feedback as well to Mondi. And he really enjoyed it too. And he said, thanks so much for forwarding that. He really appreciated the feedback too. Let me just see what else I've got. I've got a new voicemail message on SpeakPipe, which is my little voicemail thingy. Let me have a look here. I'll just get that up and running. The SpeakPipe thing is that widget on the side of the website. I've only haven't used it before, but I'm going to go and grab the email, the voicemail now, and play it for your delectation. Oops, I was wrong. That one's for Paleo Cinema, so I'll play that in 2 weeks' time. But, yeah, I did get an email from my friend Roman over in Adelaide, who said that getting the feed from the marsdrivein.blogspot.com website doesn't work, and you have to go to martiandrivein.podbean.com to get the RSS feed. So that's just a heads up for everybody. Go to martiandrivein.podbean.com if you want to get the RSS feed yourself. So that's pretty much it for the feedback. I've got a lot for next time on Paleo Cinema, so I'm going to enjoy that. So what else have I got to say? I didn't have any news from Mars this time, but you really keep up with the Curiosity Rover stuff on NASA's website. There's a lot of really good stuff there. In fact, one of the other rovers found some rock formations that look like blueberries. So if you type in Martian blueberries into Google, you'll find a bit more news about that. But Curiosity is going really well. It actually filmed a solar eclipse by one of the Martian moons. Of course, the moon's much smaller than ours, so it didn't eclipse the full sun. But there was an eclipse that got filmed by it. It took a self-portrait of it, and it looks kind of cool. So all of that stuff you can get over at the NASA website, or you can just type in Curiosity Rover in a web search engine. We'll get you there to take a look at that. Not much else to say. I'm going to go away now and chill out a little bit and watch some movies that are probably so bad I wouldn't even podcast about them. But we will see. The weather's turning nicer here. I did a long bike ride yesterday, as I said, and it's really starting to come good. I'm planting some things in the garden. Got some jasmine going and a few other nice plants. A thing called a Mexican orange blossom plant. I don't know whether it's actually from Mexico, but that's what they call it. And a few other bits and pieces. And the veggie patch is going well. We've got tomatoes in now. We've got some cabbages just coming to fruition, red cabbages, and some Brussels sprouts, which I won't eat. And a few other things in the herbs are doing really nicely. So I really find it fulfilling having the garden there, particularly when it comes to edible stuff. I am quite fond of going out the back and making a salsa from the stuff I found in the garden. So if you've got a chance at all, even if you've got a window box, there's something very basic and fulfilling about sticking very small things into the ground and having them become larger things that you can eat. I wish they had the same thing for bacon. But anyway, this is about it for this one. I really do appreciate all the nice things people are saying on Facebook and other venues about the new podcast and about the old one too. It really is gratifying to get this feedback and to know that what I do is of value to people. And even with the radio gig, I'm getting a bit of that. So it's all going very nicely at the moment. And I want to continue doing it. The one thing that pisses me off about doing a podcast, and this is totally silly, and I'll just end on this note. Why the fuck did they have to wait until I was in my 50s to invent it? Had this thing been there when I was in my 20s and 30s, I would have appreciated it a lot more. I would have been even better at it now from having 30 years of experience for it. But I really do like the fact that it's here now. And one of the great things about life is interesting things keep happening. Yes, there are dark and nasty and dangerous and stupid and ridiculous and threatening things occurring as well. But there are also a lot of cool things. And we've got to balance it out. We can't just focus on the negative stuff. The positive stuff is very groovy. And it's ours to embrace. And we really should be doing that. So anyway, take care of yourselves. Enjoy your movie watching. Watch the skies. And I'll be back with another Martian Drive-In podcast in 4 weeks. And another Paleo Cinema podcast in just 2 weeks. So take care and I'll see you then.